director of the university seminars. I am the successor to our speaker tonight, Bob Belknap, who carried the seminars through 10 difficult years to a great place, and I'm here to introduce his introducer, Deborah Martinson. Before I do, I just have a very brief announcement or two. This is the bulletin of last year's university seminars. We have copies in the back. If you'd like to know more about the seminars, feel free to take one. These are the three Schaff lectures. Today is the third of them. The Schaff lectures are published by Columbia University Press as one of the many programs of the university seminars. I'll ask you, please, to resist the urge to take any of the books in the Schaff series, which are also back there. I would never think to say that, except my own book was listed in this last week. So if you took it, you can put it back. But in any event, please don't take the books. Do take this. If you're interested in university seminars in any of its attributes and avatars, please send an email to me, pollock@columbia.edu. Very happy to have people interested in the seminars. Now, Bob Belknap, as some of you know, was my humanities teacher, and I learned how to read Crime and Punishment and many other books from him in the spring of 1958, so I'm in a somewhat suspended state of timelessness right now, and Deborah Martinson will make the introduction of Bob for his last lecture. Deborah has many roles here at Columbia. She's formerly an associate dean of Columbia's core curriculum. She teaches in the Literature and Humanities program, as well as teaching in the Slavics department and in the English and Comparative Literature departments. More than 10 years ago, she and Bob Belknap together organized the 10th International Dostoevsky Symposium, which was held at Columbia, and she's got many books out and many more to come. But for our purposes here, I think the most important thing to say about Deborah, besides the fact that she's a fine colleague and a great teacher, is that she is the current president of the International Dostoevsky Society. So in that capacity, if no other, here's Deborah Martinson. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Last year, when Bob introduced Gene Howard's Schaff lectures, he noted that none of us present knows which questions being asked today will be the standard bearers for the future and which will fizzle and disappear. Yet Bob has, in this and much else, proved himself an exception. Since the beginning of his career, Bob has asked questions about narrative, structure, plot, and memory that had anticipated entire contemporary disciplines. As we all know, for 10 years, Bob directed the university seminars, an institution that encourages what Bob calls good talk. In the words of their founder, Frank Tenenbaum, quote, "The primary aim of the university seminar is the attempt to see things whole, to merge the disciplines for the purpose of getting a unified view. The aim is synthesis, insight, wisdom, the understanding of the full incidence of the ongoing phenomenon. Bringing people together to discuss ideas and events, isn't that what Bob has done his entire life? What Bob believes of great writers, I believe of great scholars like Bob. They keep writing because they want to get it right. Bob holds that Shakespeare and Dostoevsky had certain themes that they constantly reworked. I find the same is true of Bob. Bob's two books on Dostoevsky's masterpiece, The Brothers Karamazov, The Structure of the Brothers Karamazov, reprinted by Northwestern University Press, and The Genesis of the Brothers Karamazov, are both classics cited throughout the world to this day. To use a cliched expression, Bob writes books that keep on giving. Bob's fans will not be surprised to learn that he formulated some of his book on plot while writing his dissertation, which became his first classic and which was published as The Structure of the Brothers Karamazov in 1967. For repeat attendees, the following sentences will sound familiar. Quote, "With two exceptions, every passage in the novel both precedes and follows another passage. If it resembles one of these, a cumulative effect may be discovered. If it resembles both, a transition. If neither, an interruption or even a contrast." End quote. Likewise, When Bob explains how the, quote, the narrative structure forms and varies the impact of the more rigid structure of causality, end quote, he does what Dostoevsky and Shakespeare did continually. He recycles his own work. In this case, insights that he gained when writing his senior thesis at Princeton, a study of deliberate lies in Plato, Shakespeare, and Dostoevsky. Quote, the lie is one of the easiest ways of incorporating alternatives into the causal structure itself. The second way of doing this is through error. I think we heard a variant of this last week, right? While Bob later claims that the structure examined the fixed relations in the Brothers Karamazov, whereas the genesis would study, quote, the moving patterns and patterns of motion that recur as the text emerges, my handout from the structure, which is from Bob's work, illustrates Bob's understanding of how Dostoevsky inscribes plot dynamics into the novel's structure. The first diagram at the top of the page illustrates the tension that drives the love plots. Fyodor and Dmitri, father and son, are both attracted to Grushenka, who thinks she wants her initial seducer, the Pole, yet chases after Alyosha, who loves Lise, who, in Bob's words, quote, with great self-torture offers herself to Ivan, who rejects her gently and desires Katya, end quote, who loves but tortures Ivan as she resolves to sacrifice herself for Dmitri. In short, to cite Bob's minimum for plot unity, there are a lot of things going wrong and something needs to be done. The second illustrates the resolution at novel's end. Dostoevsky created the dynamic structure. Bob brilliantly schematized it. In the genesis of the Brothers Karamazov, Bob claims, and I quote, this book rests on the sense that major literature is rarely ever invented out of nothing. Rather, its authors discover its elements in the existing writing and other materials they copy, imitate, quote, use, parody, or react to in other ways. In this sense, Dostoevsky's novels are not the work of one mysterious genius, but his collaboration with hundreds of writers, some living, some long dead, some great, some deservedly forgotten, in a common enterprise of which their work and his are inseparable parts. Although literature is participatory in some way, the results need not be uniform. Even if Dostoevsky had read exactly the same things as Barbarikin, he would have processed these materials so differently that his works would remain distinctly Dostoevskyan. And even us Slavists know that Barbarikin was deservedly forgotten. We can say the same of Bob. Few have read as deeply and widely as Bob, and many of them formulates a question, summarizes a plot, identifies the essentials, or compresses an argument like he does. The way that Bob entitles chapters and subchapters in the Genesis conveys a lot about Dostoevsky, but also about Bob. I quote, Chapter 2. Dostoevsky read enormously in books and periodicals, old and new, Russian and European, good and bad, literary and non-literary. The same can be said of Bob. He reads enormously in books and periodicals, old and new, Russian and European and Asian, good and bad, literary and non-literary. Moreover, what Bob said of Dostoevsky, I might quote, one can almost argue that the burden of proof rests heavier on the scholar who hypothesizes that Dostoevsky had not read a given work, text, than on one who claims he had. One of his Litcom students said about Bob, I quote, Professor Belknap seems to have read every book ever written. While it is true that the core curriculum has influenced Bob's scholarship, it is equally true that Bob was already a core scholar before he arrived at Columbia. Bob's humanities career began in earnest the summer of his 14th year, when he started to read to his blind 80-year-old neighbor. At her request, they began with Plato. The following summer, they tackled Greek tragedy. So when Bob went to Princeton, he headed straight for the humanities. Bob studied with R.P. Blackmore, who read his lectures. Bob, on the other hand, never reads lectures. He may lecture, but he never reads. As you can see, he writes his talk, but he memorizes it and uses the written version only as a prompt, a standard to which we can all aspire. Bob's scholarship is pithy. One of my favorite of Bob's articles is entitled The Unrepentant Confession. As Bob describes it, a repentant confession, like St. Augustine's, takes the form, I did or do or am this, and it is wrong. An apologia, like Rousseau's, takes the form, I did, or do, or am this, and it is right. The unrepentant confession, like the underground man's, takes the form, I did it, and it's wrong, but that's the way I am. The unrepentant confession thus violates generic norms. Bob explains, quote, the genre of the confession presupposes that the person confessed to has some sort of authority over the one confessing. In literary confession, the reader assumes this authority, and those unrepentant confessions withdraw this authority from the reader in a dramatically provocative way. The power of these passages comes from the breaking of social and moral taboos, but most powerfully from breaking these literary rules which govern our reading of all normal confessions. Bob is provocative in a different way. Even though he is the person with authority, Bob assumes that we, his students, possess knowledge, and he stimulates our neurons so that we will make all kinds of connections. I will close with a subtitle for Chapter 8 of Bob's Genesis, which, as Bob himself points out, can be equally applied to Crime and Punishment, the subject of this evening's lecture. Quote, Dostoevsky led his readers into Russian radicalism in order to show them the way out, end quote. Bob, you have led us into the world of plots. Now, please show us the way out.
Thank you, Deborah. That was nice. We're going to be talking today about the plots of a novel. I'll use the word plots in the plural, I think, because novels are the longest genre we've been talking about. Our friend Aristotle, for all his learning, had never read a modern European novel. We have to maybe use a few of the standard remarks that are made about epics in the tradition of literary criticism, because there is no tendency to link epics and novels. They're both long, and they're both narrative. You don't use actors, you use a figure who intervenes between what happened in the work and the reader's experience. I'll come back to that in a moment. This linkage between epics and novels was quite popular for a long time. The person who sort of pushed it under was Michael Bakhtin, who said the epic is the opposite of a novel. The epic valorizes the value system, the world of the characters that it presents, and a novel undercuts and undermines the world of the characters. Novels are inherently subversive in his view, and that's become the general sense. So we have to look at novels in a rather separate, fresh way, and realize that nobody took them seriously for a long, long time. When a nice young lady told Samuel Johnson that she loved novels, he said, that, dear, is because you are a dunce. It didn't please her, and he issued one of the great apologies of all time. Oh, I never would have said that if I thought it might be true. But this is about the level that people handle novels with, up through the 18th and way into the 19th century. They were entertaining, and the novelist knew an awful lot about novelist technique, but nobody bothered to say much about it. That was really true up until Henry James began to write his prefaces. I think that was the first really serious literary mind that got to work on novels. And James said the important thing about a novel is that this narrator, through whom we experience the whole novel, has to be a consistent entity. The narrator can be sensible or foolish, sympathetic or nasty, any adjective you like, but whatever the narrator is, he or she has to be that consistently. If the narrator can see into the mind of a character, that's fine, but if it's that kind of a narrator, you can't have a page where the narrator guesses what the character is thinking by the gestures or the facial expression or something like that. That's fine too, but your narrative figure has to be consistent. Otherwise, the reader will lose the contact with the world that's being presented. This doctrine about narration is something that describes the 19th century novels of Western Europe very, very well. James was talking this way because he knew his Dickens, he knew his Thackeray, he knew Walter Scott, and this is the way their novels worked. He knew the European ones just as well. The Russian novels bothered Henry James. He knew they were magnificent. He read them and they hit him hard in French or later English translations. But they shouldn't, because they broke the rules that I've just described. At one point he described them as fluid puddings. They were formless. He knew they were powerful, he knew they did things to him, and yet it was wrong. About Tolstoy, he was upset about the promiscuous shifting of viewpoint and center. Viewpoint to him was this figure of the narrator. And what was going on, I think, is that in the 19th century, it became impossible in England and France and Germany to write 18th century novels. I know one person who blames that fact on Lawrence Stern, who poked such fun at the 18th century novelistic tradition in Tristram Shandy, that nobody seriously could come back to it after that. I argue that the Russians escaped that. They loved Stern, two of the greatest Russian writers were called the Russian Stern. One was Nicholas Karamzin, the other one was Nicholas Gogol. They adapted him, they adopted him, and he became a part of the Russian tradition and enabled the Russians to go on writing 18th century novels. In this period, the Russians would do things that James deplored. We've just seen that. He thought that's because they had no rules for writing novels. I'm going to argue that they had rules, but it was a different set of rules. In England, the narrator, as I've just described him, was very closely related to the world of character. In fact, one of Thackeray's narrators becomes Thackeray's narrators becomes a major character in another novel. You can make the world of characters and the world of narrators very close. And if you're going to do that, of course your narrator has to have a consistent identity of the kind I've just described. In Russia, more in the 18th century tradition, the narrator is very closely connected with the plot. And there's a Gogol story, for example, where at the beginning the narrator loves the furs on the overcoat of the hero. That is, the narrator is somewhere between 2 and 4. It's about the right age for stroking someone's overcoat and adoring it. A little later, the narrator says, it's been said that this hero of my story had a tail, but everybody knows that that's nonsense. Only witches have tails, and not all of them. This is somebody quite a little older, not adolescent yet, but coming along. And the next time the narrator appears, he talks about the bureaucracy and the way a court case takes a generation to move through the courts. He's a sophisticated bureaucrat by then, passing through the town in his carriage. And at the end of this story, the narrator says, it's tedious on this earth, gentlemen. Those are the last words of Winston Churchill, dying in his mid-90s. So you have a narrator who has an entire plot built into the life of this fairly short story in which astonishingly little happens. So here's where the action is, in the narration. Gogol in that story is using a novel in a different way, using a different set of techniques, but using them with the technical skill and control that James, who was probably the most worldly and sophisticated of all novelists, somehow didn't see. So the Russians were up to something special, and this is what I'd like to get at with Crime and Punishment. Let's look at the way this novel does something that I think is enormously important. People often talk about two kinds of novels. Novels that tell you what happens and novels that show you what happens. I want to argue today that in the 19th century, Dostoevsky was one of the people who invented a third kind of novel, the novel that makes you, the reader, experience what happened. It's the manipulative novel. It does things to you, and if the novel is describing somebody who goes mad, you get a little bit psychotic as you read it. And whatever the other experience, the novel makes you go through it, and using these the kind of techniques that I've just described. Let's think of Crime and Punishment again in an artificial way as two works of literature, one entitled Crime and one entitled Punishment. Crime is a novella, it's seven chapters long. Punishment is the rest of the novel. And I'd like to take you through Crime, looking at the sujet, looking at the reader's experience of the first seven chapters of the novel. The first three are an interesting set because Aristotle wouldn't have liked this. You see three plots in the first three chapters. The first plot is told by a narrator who stands fairly far outside of the scene. He hovers between the two ways of describing Raskolnikov, the hero. Sometimes he describes him by the way he moves. He must have been thinking this from the way he moved. Other times, goes right into his mind and tells him what's going on there. So you have these two techniques that Henry James could not put in the same chapter, but a Russian can, because he's using a different organizing system. And Raskolnikov is involved with something whose importance is underlined by a technique that a friend of mine, Olga Mersen, calls tabooing. That is, he says, I can't do certain things until after that. And that is sometimes italicized, sometimes not, but we're not told what it is. And Raskolnikov doesn't want to give it a name. It takes some little time before we realize that is a murder. But tabooing it in that manner foregrounds it for us. We realize that there's something going on. This is a technique I mentioned the other day called curiosité in the trade. It's the counterpart of suspense. Suspense is you're wondering what's going to happen later. Curiosité is you're wondering what on earth is going on right now in the text. And Dostoevsky gets that going very quickly. The second chapter introduces another narrative, the drunken clerk Marmeladov, who tells about a second community. We've learned about Raskolnikov and his life as a an impoverished ex-student in the first chapter. In the second chapter, we learn about Marmeladov's family. His daughter, Sonia, his horrible wife, and the other children in the novel. These two plots are connected. Sonia, after all, in the epilogue, which I'll get to later on, is going to marry Raskolnikov. That takes time, it takes 600 pages. But 600 pages, incidentally, in a novel that came out monthly. Dickens came out once a week, Dostoevsky tended to come out once a month. That's a long time for you readers. You have a plot that is in which Raskolnikov is involved, but then in the third chapter you have another plot using another narrative technique. The first novel Dostoevsky wrote was a letter novel, and here you have a letter which lays out another plot of the novel, the plot involving the Svidrigailov family. And there's very little contact between the Svidrigailov plot and the Marmeladov plot. There are a couple of moments when they do connect. At the very end of the novel, which is essentially Dickensian, Svidrigailov, the villain's fortune, which takes care of the Marmeladov children. That's a standard pattern. And there are other points of contact, but for practical purposes, we have these two flanking plots around the Raskolnikov plot, and they're all laid out in the first three chapters. The fourth chapter, we get Raskolnikov's voice as a literary critic, doing a literary critique of that letter he'd received from his mother, wondering, as we all wonder, how calculatingly she had destroyed what's going on. But also, that chapter lays out how it is that you can have a really coherent novel with two plots in it which are barely connected causally. And the answer, of course, is they're connected by analogy. They resemble one another. And Dostoevsky worried that you might have missed that. So he has Raskolnikov say, aha, Sonia has become a prostitute to support her family. My sister is about to marry a really vile character in order to support me. And the link between those two plots in the world of similarity is made absolutely clear to us, even though we might have missed it, although a good many of us will have seen it already, he's just confirming it. So Dostoevsky is working to unify the novel in that fourth chapter. In the next chapter, you have that huge and horrible dream about the beating of a horse to death, about its tender eyes, the drunken peasant who is takes stakes and finally a crowbar and destroys his own horse. It's a scene that people have always said is totally and completely Russian, even though a large part of it is lifted out of Les Miserables. This is the way that Dostoevsky worked. So when Raskolnikov wakes up from that dream, as you remember, he feels as if he has shed a huge burden. He's able to breathe normally. And suddenly, and he decides, how could I ever have imagined taking an axe and bludgeoning that pawnbroker to death? What a ridiculous idea. He is cured of this delusion. And at the same time, Dostoevsky has organized the entire set of associations in the novel in a pair of different kinds. On one side we have, say, the unconscious world, the world in a inside a dream. On the other side, the conscious world of daydreaming and fantasizing. One side, the world of impulse. The other side, the world of afterthought. You notice that when Raskolnikov goes to the Marmeladov family, he gives away the last money he has, practically. Then on the stairs, he says, why did I do that? They have Sonia to support them. I don't have anybody. When he gives away money to help a girl who has been raped or molested or assaulted, he sees her wandering drunk along the street. He gives it away, then he suddenly changes his mind. And the word suddenly is very important. There have been good articles about the word suddenly in Dostoevsky. He suddenly changes his mind. Says to the cop he's trying to get to take the girl home, forget it. And his reasoning is, statistics say this is going to happen to a certain number of girls. So we've set up another opposition, which is part of the same pair of oppositions, humanity and statistics. Sociology is the evil. You have religion over against mathematics. Have nature as opposed to science. You have intuition as opposed to reason. You have air as opposed to enslavement, and so on. There's this rigid pair of worlds. It's a very, very simple ordering of the universe in this novel. And Raskolnikov moves between these two worlds suddenly, time after time after time. The guy is split. The word Raskol in Russian means split. And you have a character who moves very far into this world of generosity, humanity, instinct, and very far into this other world, and drops between them. So we become accustomed to this, and by the end of chapter 5, Dostoevsky has trained us to see this pair of worlds, this split in the novel. He's been working on us, And the split finally comes to be maybe the central fact in the novel. Then something weird happens. Raskolnikov learns that the old pawnbroker is going to be all alone in her apartment the next day. Now, you and I have often learned that somebody is going to be all alone in their apartment the next day. And Raskolnikov, at that moment in his career, is just the same as we are. He has absolutely resolved not to commit a murder. And I hope that most of us are in the same state. Here is, but when he hears this, suddenly he feels enslaved. All of the associations on that side of his split take hold. And not because it suddenly becomes possible to commit the murder he's absolutely decided not to do. The reason is a fascinating one. It's because of the coincidence. Because there's no reason. The causal system is explicitly excluded from his learning about this. We're told very specifically he has no reason for taking that particular route home. It just happens. And that is what leads him to feel driven, compelled. He's lost his free will because of this coincidence. And Dostoevsky studies this by entering Raskolnikov's mind, standing a little apart from him, and saying, during these months, he had become superstitious. Superstition in those days, in the 1860s, was a nasty word to use about any radical in Russia. The Russian radicals at that time treasured their rationality. They thought Auguste Comte had written, the world moved from an age of superstition to an age of religion, and on finally to an age of science. And that was the vision. So you were two or three steps back in the history of humanity if you were superstitious. This was just about the nastiest thing you could say about anybody. And it's what Raskolnikov was suffering from, and what drove him at that moment to lose his sense of free will and go out and commit this appalling hatchet murder of a worthless old pawnbroker and her loving, sad, not very bright sister, but a woman who was immensely kind and valuable to a great many others. After that, in the final chapter, Raskolnikov starts his getaway and moves to the door, when suddenly realizes that he'd left the thing open, moves to the door, and hears people coming upstairs. And so he hooks the door until they're out of the way, and I'm abbreviating things, and they come, turns out they're coming to the pawnbroker. So he stands 2 or 3 inches from these people on opposite sides of the door and listens to their conversation. And as he stands there, holding his breath, you and I want him to get away. What Dostoevsky has done is to make every one of us an accessory after the fact in an absolutely horrifying hatchet murder. We are all rooting for him to get away with it. I had an undergraduate in the psych department one time who hooked up riggers to a lie detector, which really is just a measure of whether your hands are sweating. As people read that passage, their hands sweat. And I think if we had a machine for people reading that passage, we would find that their breath, their breathing changed. That is, Dostoevsky makes us participate in this horrifying murder in part one of the novel. There are all sorts of strange things going on in this novel. The violence is certainly real, but it's interesting. If you think of the number of beatings, it's very substantial. People, Razumihin slugs a cop, a watchman, Marmolada's wife, William whams his head against the floor by the hair, any number of different people are attacked and beaten, not just the old pawnbroker. What's interesting is that there isn't a single fair fight. Nobody fights back. There are lots and lots of beatings and no fights. Now, this isn't for lack of reciprocity, because the verbal beatings are very often responded to, not always, but you get good verbal attacks that produce really awfully good responses. So it's not an inability to fight back, it's an inability to fight back physically that seems to be a standard pattern. What interests me is there's another thing that's one-sided in the novel. There are no happy marriages, and there's no good sex outside of the marriages. This isn't from prudery, because there's a lot of quite sexual talk one place or another. So that's not why it's missing. And there's quite a lot of real love in the novel. But the love between Sonia and Raskolnikov is unconsummated until the very end of the novel. The love between Razumihin and Dunya is unconsummated until the epilogue. So these things are left out, they're missing from the novel. There seems to be sort of a rule, if it's reciprocal, it's not physical. If it's physical, it's not reciprocal. And that applies both to sex and violence in the novel. Something funny is going on here. And I think maybe by looking at the epilogue, we can get a feel for what that might be. So people have often said the epilogue doesn't seem to belong. Some people think Raskolnikov should just commit suicide and get rid of him. Other people somehow feel that the epilogue is different from the rest of the novel. They're right. It is different. And it's different for a very specific reason. This is a novel of rehearsals. The opening scene is Raskolnikov's rehearsal of the murder. He goes up to the pawnbroker's, gives her a watch to pawn, and starts out rehearsing the murder. Here, that beating the horse dream is a rehearsal of the murder. Same way, he rehearses his confession time after time after time. He confesses to the explosive lieutenant in a bar in the police from the police station, and then says, "Oh, I've gotcha! I was joking." He confesses to Sonia. He falls down on his knees and confesses in the city square. He keeps getting ready to make his confession, and finally goes to the police station and does it. Incidentally, to the only person in the novel who does have a apparently happy family, the explosive lieutenant there. There's something going on in this novel. I think what that is that it's true in a good many of the Christian churches that confession is not the result of repentance. When Raskolnikov tells Sonia, "I killed the old prom broker," or makes it clear that he did, then he says, after one of these sudden shifts, "But I just killed a blood-sucking insect." Confession is the means to repentance. One confesses in order to put one's spirit in shape to repent. And this is what's going on. And the epilogue is the career of Raskolnikov after all those rehearsals, when he's finally managed to confess. Then he's ready to begin getting ready to repent. But it's only after that real confession that repentance is in the cards. So I think you have to look at it that way. Basically, in the novel, there are two operative theories about murder. One comes from a book by Napoleon III, His Life of Julius Caesar. It's the idea that certain people in the world are so important that they are entitled to kill people if necessary. If Isaac Newton could not have made his contributions to the world without killing somebody, well, that was understandable. His contributions were more important than a few lives. The same for Napoleon, the same for Julius Caesar, same for a few people in the world. And Raskolnikov is, among other things, trying on that Napoleonic vision for size. And is the way you tell whether this is the kind of person is whether they can carry it off. Napoleon did, he was responsible for millions of deaths, but he didn't order a lot of people just to be wiped out. But okay, when he thought it was necessary, he did, and didn't give it a thought. So that meant he was entitled to. That's one vision of murder, that it's a very bad thing, but if a very great person is doing it, well, okay. The other vision of murder is the vision of Porfiry Petrovich, the detective. He thinks that murder is one symptom of a disease, and that disease has a second system, which is a need to get caught, and that a murderer will, as a part of the same disease that leads to the murder, show off the money he's stolen, or go back to the scene of the crime, or boast about the murder in a most inappropriate place. In fact, do exactly what Raskolnikov does. Porfiry thinks that if the murder is still goes undetected, for all of these efforts to get caught that the murderer goes through, he'll confess. And if the murderer can't bring himself to confess, he'll commit suicide. And he doesn't see, Porfiry doesn't see any other way out. So that these marvelous interrogations that he conducts in the novel, they're cruel in some ways. The manipulation of Raskolnikov is sheer brilliance. He's trying to save Raskolnikov's life because he feels if Raskolnikov hasn't succeeded in getting caught, the only way to save his life is confession. There's a wonderful passage. Porfiry, as you know, likes to talk incoherently. It throws people off balance. So he says, in his last interrogation, well, it goes without saying, I remember, why look, he's even trembling. Don't worry, my sweetheart, thou wilt be done. Wander around a bit, only you mustn't wander too far. He's saying, I'm not going to arrest you right now. In any event, I do have one more big favor to ask of you, he added, lowering his voice. A ticklish matter, but an important one. If in any event, which I don't believe will happen and consider quite against your nature, in the event, well, in any event, if you should feel the inclination in these 40 or 50 hours to finish the matter in some other way, in some fantastic manner, to inflict a bit of violence on yourself. An absurd proposition, but, well, you must forgive me. Then leave a brief but circumstantial note. That's it. Two volumes, just two bits of writing, and tell about the stone under which the stolen money had been buried. That's Porphyry's interrogation technique. Now, how are we going to decide between these two theories? Well, we conduct a scientific experiment. And the scientific experiment is the plot of Crime and Punishment. We have two people, Raskolnikov and Svidrigailov, both of whom have killed at least two people. Raskolnikov is probably, Svidrigailov has killed three, and Lizaveta, the second person Raskolnikov kills, is almost always pregnant. So in some sense they've both killed three people. Svidrigailov gets away with the murder, one would say, and commits suicide. Raskolnikov confesses and moves on, finally, in the epilogue, to repentance. Dostoevsky has used the plot of the novel to put us through the experience of being a murderer and to demonstrate that Porphyry's theory is right. Thank you.
We'll take questions, or Bob will take questions. There are microphones. The first person to ask a question, please say your name, and when you're done, hand the microphone to the next person who will be asking a question. Okay, any questions? Comments? Was he right? Yes, over here. Somebody, a mic to hear. Yes, no, we got it. No, we have one that side, one this side. Here we go. Okay, Robert, your mic.
First of all, thank you for this wonderful lecture. I was very intrigued by your observation that there's almost never any reciprocity of violence or sex, which is to say anything physical, in Dostoevsky's world. And I'm wondering, is that because the body for Dostoevsky is almost never a place of communion? Instead, is it that the body for Dostoevsky is perhaps the first manifestation of my internal schism, my internal split from myself, like the very fact that I have a body that I can't really fully identify with, the body that in Notes from Underground bumps into the officer and then causes that whole series of events and neurotic stirrings. Is that what it is, or is it something? I thought you were going to say that it's something connected to plot, but I didn't hear you say that.
I don't really understand that phenomenon. It does run through most of Dostoevsky's novels, not just this one. I think Some of it is simply that when he's dealing with the melodramatic scenes, the weak turn out to be very strong. Maybe the prime example of that is the scene in Crime and Punishment where Dunja and Svidrigaïlov are locked into a room from which no sounds can be heard. She is entirely at the mercy of this person who's twice her size and wants to rape her. Or he doesn't want to rape her, he wants to make love with her. She refuses. He threatens and moves towards her, and she pulls a gun on him. Turns out to be his gun that she's picked up on his estate when she was the babysitter. And he says, "Oh, that changes the situation. Shoot me." She does and misses at point blank in a small room. Tries again. He says, "Well, I'll reload." He reloads for her. She shoots again, the gun misfires. She can't shoot him, in a short. And throws the gun aside. And then he says, "You really can't love me, possibly?" And she says, "Never, no way." And he lets her go. That is, when he has the power, he lets her go. I've often thought that tragedy as a literary genre is about the weakness of the strong. And that this kind of a novel is about the power of the weak. The people being beaten up are the winners in this novel. And that may have something to do with what's going on to explain this.
At the beginning of your talk, you described the novel as manipulative and then made a reference to the reader experiencing the madness of the characters. I was wondering if you could elaborate on the madness of Raskolnikov and Svidrigaïlov in the novel. You didn't really talk so much about insanity.
In this novel, I don't think we have any full-blown madness. You have this disease of murder that is elaborately described and almost medically described. But in other places where you have serious questions of madness, as in The Possessed, I think people do feel disoriented in reading parts of The Possessed. It's other emotions, like that emotion at the doorway that I was describing, where you're manipulated into this.
Jerry Spivak, I've never had so much fun listening to somebody talk about literature, but In the past, in my torments, I remember people taking symbolism as an approach to literature, and then at later times I heard that people dealt with post-something or other and another post-something. To what do you ascribe all of these different schools developing to torment so many students in the way they approach literature?
We all want to be one up on our colleagues, and it's enormously important to know the latest vocabulary and the latest things that are this year's thing to say. I'm very sympathetic with the people who drive you crazy with all sorts of fancy ways of looking at them.
Do you also sympathize with the students?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's part of the game and part of the fun. I always enjoy listening to people who talk about things that I almost understand. Is that other than that back there?
I'm Padma Desai. I'm an economist working on Russia. Began on the Soviet Union in 1964. And this is a very personal comment based on what you said, Bob. When Russians look at me, and I visit Russia very often, maybe 2-3 times a year, and they ask me, looking at me, why Russia? And I immediately say, because of Dostoevsky. And the response almost always is, but he is so disturbing. And I say, what is the point of stepping into an area which is not disturbing, which is lacking in challenges, right? I read Dostoevsky, Crime and Punishment, in India, in my father's library, when I think I was 14 years of age, Bob, 65 years ago, 66 years ago. I don't remember whose translation it was, but I felt completely disoriented. This was a love story gone wrong. This was a story of sin and redemption. What was it? I couldn't eat for a couple of days. This is all real. So I said to myself, I'm going to read this novel in Russian. That was the pledge I made to myself. So when I went to Harvard in 1955 on an American fellowship, I of course joined the economics department, did my PhD in economics, but I also joined the Slavic department, learned Russian for 4 years, continued it in Delhi. And here I am listening to you. This was an experience, and this was so manipulative. I completely changed my career, sort of completely got involved into the Soviet Union, Russia, because of Dostoevsky and Crime and Punishment.
Thank you. Okay. You didn't mention it, but I wonder if you take seriously what I know you know about the political theory of Crime and Punishment, that the self-censored political, not substratum, very important part of the stratum, Raskolnikov is not a lunatic with delusions of grandeur, but a practicing terrorist. He's working up, well, if he can kill the old lady and not feel any conscience, well, then he can kill the Tsar, who's better than Karakazov. That when this gets out, it's the secret political policeman, Porfiry Petrovich, the only one without really a last name, you know he's a secret political policeman, is then seconded, as the British say, to the case. And, of course, you find the article which justifies terrorism in a suppressed revolutionary journal. And, well, you know the theory, but do you think it's interesting to pursue it?
After his first run-in with the authorities, which led to 9 or 10 years in Siberia, 4 of them in prison camp, Dostoevsky was fairly careful. He did have there his journal did publish one thing that was forbidden, and he had to spend 4 days in a jail. I think it was 4 days, but they gave him the choice of when. And he went and sat in a local jail for 4 days, but he certainly did draw from the prison world and from his world life among the radicals in the 1840s a good deal of the vocabulary and the manner of thought of both those communities. And I think that's cropping up in all of these works. When he was in the prison camp, managed to keep a little notebook with phrases that the convicts would use, and some of those actual phrases from that notebook turned up in the Brothers Karamazov that he wrote 30 years later. So this was very much a real part of his life. I think that would be the outline of an answer, right?
I'm gonna ask what I think will have to be the last question. Bob, your outline of the book in the beginning was an argument that the cultural presumption was of a transition, a progress from superstition to religion to science. But the actual book says the progress is from superstition to science to religion. And I wonder if you would say something about whether that's intentional or that's an overreading.
I think it's definitely intentional for Dostoevsky. By the time he wrote this book, he was, and probably all his life, he was a deeply religious man. It wasn't science that he distrusted, it was scientism. The idea that science contained the answer to all the questions. That's what he was really out to attack, and does constantly here.
Let's just thank Bob.
My gratitude to you all for coming. The university seminars have prepared a simple collation outside. Please join us for it, and thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.